Tech Dorks.
Welcome to the Tech Dorks Podcast, where I, Rob Swindell, and my Canadian friend Stephen Hurd discuss things interesting to us and maybe to you, the listener. This show is an unscripted, unedited, unprofessional look into what interests Stephen and I. The only subjects off-limits...
off-limits, maybe?
That's the word. Why is work in World War III? If you don't know the difference between PCP and TCP, then this show may not be for you, but still, we hope you enjoy. Should I do that again?
No. It's unscripted and unedited.
Yeah. Yeah. All right, so this is episode...
You mess up the intro every week. I mean, it's becoming a tradition.
Yeah, well, it's I got to get through that quick to do it in that little time limit for that little sound
clip. No, it's a tough job. I mean, not everyone can do it.
But it's not funny when it's all flubbed.
I think it's funny.
All right. Well, maybe other people think it's funny.
Yeah.
So it's November 21st, almost 2 in the morning.
2015.
Yeah, 2015. In the morning. I had to fight my girls out of the studio. This is our 11th episode.
Oh.
That's kind of amazing, huh?
I don't know. I mean, since we're not basing our doing another episode on popularity or anything, I don't know what would actually make us stop.
Well, I seem like a lot to me when I was, mainly when I was publishing the last episode, I'm like, episode 10 already. Now, if we were actually doing it weekly, we'd be, you know, in the higher numbers by now, but, it's proven difficult.
Mm-hmm.
You were out of town?
I was traveling. Yeah. Yep. I was at a conference in San Jose, so that is a valid excuse.
Totally.
Yeah. And then so I was sick.
Everybody, yeah. I think you're still sick, probably.
You know, I'm feeling better. I'm still a little stuffed up, and my throat's still a little sore, but it doesn't hurt to open my eyes, so that's good. You know,
I totally thought I was coming down with something Thursday night, and then I took an Advil cold and sinus, and it like knocked it out, and I got a lot of work done after that.
Well, I'm glad that I didn't make you sick. That was kind of my concern, was that I'd make everyone at work sick.
Yeah, I think it was just allergies. Sometimes hard to tell the difference.
Well, not for me. I don't really suffer from allergies, as far as I know.
Yeah, I have my whole life.
Yeah.
And sometimes, you know, with the weather changes and if there's winds and dust and pollen and all that,
it sounds terrible, but unfortunately I just can't commiserate well about it. It's like people who get seasick, I just, you know, it's like, wow, that looks like you're miserable and it really sucks.
I've only been seasick once or twice. It is horrible, especially if you can't get off the boat, but luckily, I don't get seasick very often because I do spend a lot of time on boats with my dad.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I've never actually been seasick.
Oh? So no motion sickness at all?
No, I've always really enjoyed motion, to be honest. I mean,
I think I have a pretty strong stomach for that as well. But I don't remember the occasions when I have been seasick. I just don't remember when. Maybe it was the cruise ship. I don't know.
Yeah, my wife got a touch of seasickness once when we were on a cruise. I had to pop down to the drug dealer.
Yeah, Dramamine works well.
Well, whatever they gave me. I mean, I wasn't picking on. Like, my wife's seasick and she wants some pills. So they gave me a little packet with some pills in it. I gave them to my wife and she
makes you tired.
And I got to sleep.
It does. Fix it.
Well, it was late anyway. She probably wanted to sleep, so. Yeah.
So, you got new hard drives?
I did. I got 6 new Western Digital 4 terabyte drives, put them into a ZFS array. So, I've got 2 mirrored VDEVs, or 3 mirrored VDEVs, sorry, and then I striped them all together, so. I got 12 terabytes of storage, of which I'm using very little right now, but some of it will definitely be set up this weekend for backups.
Yeah, so originally you were talking about getting the the Hitachi drive, right? So,
yeah. Yeah, they're not Hitachi anymore, and they're not HSDC or whatever they were anymore. I'm pretty sure they were bought by Western Digital.
Right, but you didn't end up getting those. You got a different Western Digital, like the traditional Western Digital.
Yeah, I ended up getting those because, you know, the I in RAID originally stood for inexpensive, and, you know, spending $300 per drive is kind of forgetting the fact that the whole idea is to enable you to use inexpensive drives. Maybe we should edit that out. Maybe we should redo that.
And one of them was DOA, or almost DOA, right? It died.
It was alive when it arrived, but so didn't I already tell this story on the podcast?
No.
Oh. So anyway, I'd gotten the 6 new drives. I was all happy. And so Saturday morning, I got up, I put all the drives in my system, and then I realized that was a mistake because my server already had 3 drives in it. I only had 6 SATA ports on the motherboard. So I was like, well, I have to get the data copied over. Well, no problem. I'm running ZFS. So what I'll do is I'll do like 3 drives in a stripe set and then add my mirror drives afterward, right? So I'll do all the copying with the stripe set, and then I'll mirror them, and everything will be great.
Now, ZFS is a free BSD-specific thing?
Actually, it was created by Sun for Solaris first, and then, you know, it was open-sourced along with Solaris. And,
oh, so it's been around a while.
Yeah. Like 8 years, maybe? Maybe 10? I don't know. And then it got open sourced, and
Is it Z for zip? Like it's compressed because it's compressed?
No, it's for zettabyte.
Oh, right.
Yeah.
But it is compressed, right?
You can enable compression. I mean, it's not...
Okay, so it's an optional feature of...
Excuse me. Yeah, it's optional. It works really good. I'm actually surprised at how well it works, actually. But, so I was doing that, and, you know, I set up the copy, and it was going to take a few hours, so I went and helped a friend with her computer, and I got home, and the copy was still going, so I was like, oh, okay. So I sat down and watched some TV, and, you know, a couple hours later, I came back in just to check on it, and I noticed the completion was the same percentage, like it hadn't copied any more. So I took a look, and one of my old hard drives was failing, so I was getting a lot of error messages anyway. So I didn't notice that one of those error messages was for one of the new drives. So because it was a stripe set, when one of the drives goes, you lose everything. So I ended up, you know, having to recopy everything. So I took the one dead hard drive out, put another
brand new dead hard drive.
Right. Well, I mean, it worked for an hour.
Yeah.
Put a different one in, recreated the stripe set, restarted the copy.
I don't think that's ever happened to me. I don't recall ever having a drive be DOA or die, you know, within the first, you know, week.
I've had them end up DOA, but I mean, there was a time I was a network administrator and a system administrator, so I would buy cases of hard drives and, you know, you'd often get one or two dead. It wasn't...
Oh, you must have been making the big bucks.
No, I wasn't.
Well, you were buying cases of hard drives, I mean.
Well, okay. I was not buying cases of hard drives.
Oh,
I was ordering cases of hard drives and installing them.
Yeah.
But yeah, so... And that's actually why where I really got my... what do you call that?
Experience?
Loyalty to Seagate.
Oh.
Because their warranty on their enterprise drives was amazing. It was 5 years, and they would cross-ship. So if you had a bad hard drive, you call them up, give them the serial number, they'd mail you a new one, you'd mail them the dead one, and you'd be off and running faster. So anyway, I reset up my stripe set, copied everything over, added my 2 other good drives. So I had 2 mirrored VDEVs and 1 just kind of hanging out there ready to take down all my storage if it died. And it was like a week before I got the 6th drive in there. But now it's all good.
And I did not pull the trigger on a new hard drive yet.
Yeah, you were looking at that one with the shingled recording.
Yeah, the 8 terabyte Seagate.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. I'm a little scared of it. A little gun shy, I guess, because it just seems like, you know, some people say, oh, you know, when writing to it, it just kind of hangs for long periods of time, and you think the drive's dead, and you come back an hour later, and it finally starts up again, and other people are like, it's fine. It's just a little bit slow on writing, but they say the reads are fast. And then other people say the reads are slow compared to a normal drive. So,
yeah, and it's hard to really get a feel for what fast and slow means.
Well, there's numbers. I mean, there are you know, benchmarks I've seen, and certainly the more official benchmarks all look like it is a decent read drive. You know, reading from it should be fine. But still, I don't want to write to it and then have it just kind of pause for long periods of time.
Yeah, and depending on your file system, I mean, a lot of file systems actually have a last access time. So any read actually also involves a write. So that could be involved.
Yeah. Yeah, I think NTFS has that.
Lot of file systems do. I mean, you can turn it off, but unless you think of turning it off, you're going to have a problem. And sometimes...
Well, those are tiny writes, though. You know, that should
right, but it's well, it's still a block, right?
Yeah.
And modern drives use 4K blocks, so it's not tiny anymore.
Well, an 8 terabyte drive is probably going to be a lot bigger block size, too.
It won't be bigger than 4K.
You can set it when you format the drive.
Not that block size, the real block size.
Oh. Yeah.
the actual block size that the drive uses, like the
cluster.
That one. Well, it's not really a cluster anymore. But anyway, yeah, I mean, they can't really go above 4K because that's the size of a page. And pretty much every common piece of hardware today. So going higher than the page size, it's going to be useless.
You know, it is funny, all those the words that they reused. Like, you know, paragraph and page and word. Mm-hmm. And
yeah, we'll just make up a new definition for it. That way everyone will understand what we mean.
Well, the relationships make a little bit of sense, but you know, then they kind of lose it after a while. You know what I mean? You know, especially when...
Well, I mean, they've been using that terminology for like 40 years now.
Yeah.
So...
Yeah.
Eventually, it's going to stop being really relevant or
right.
Just a
well,
couple
pieces. Right, well, word now doesn't really mean anything. I mean, it's... Typically, well, it's the size of an integer register on a processor, but... Yeah.
It has meaning. It's just it has a lot of different meanings.
Yeah. a lot of different architectures now. And
even the relationship between the native size of an access and particular things doesn't even make sense anymore. I mean, a lot of the time your memory can be accessed in multiple different ways, and the natural size of that just depends on how you access it. So, mm-hmm. You know,
it's faster, maybe a little bit faster if you access it in a certain way or with a certain alignment.
Right. Yeah. And, you know, it no longer has a single natural size. So, I mean, you don't really see it as much. Like, I mean, well, even the 386 was like that, right? I mean, you could access the registers as 16-bit registers. You could access them as 32-bit registers. I mean, what was the natural size of that?
And 8-bit registers, yeah.
Yeah, so what was the natural size of the processor's registers? Well, there was multiple ones.
Yeah, depending on what mode you're in, too. Like, if you're in virtual 86 mode.
Well, that just took away some of them. I mean, even in, you know, whatever they call real mode? No, real mode's the... Even in the regular 32-bit mode, I mean...
Protected mode.
You could... access two 16-bit registers or a 32-bit register.
Yeah, yeah.
You know,
I can still access a byte, yeah.
So, you know, there wasn't a single natural size anymore. And they've extended that even further.
So I had I had a Windows episode earlier this week. I came home from work and sat at my computer, and or maybe I'd been home for a little while anyway, and I was tired and I was about ready to go to bed, and I saw, I think I had to reboot the computer for some other reason, or maybe I just saw it, there was a Windows update. It said, you know, there's a Windows update pending, you know, you should reboot your computer. Mm. Like, okay, sure, I'll reboot it. So, you know, rebooted, and I didn't realize the update that it was installing was actually a major upgrade.
Right.
You know, and you know, it's not obvious by the Windows update, you know, what it tells you. It just says, you know, update for Windows 10, you know, and then I come to learn that it was update to Windows 10 version 1511, which is, you know, the 11th month of 2015. Build 1056 or 10586. Real catchy version name there.
Yeah. Well, the version name is 10.
Yeah. Well, anyway, so I mean, it goes through the whole, you know, welcome to your new computer thing. And we got lots of new features to tell you about and show you, but it doesn't tell you or show you anything. You know, and then when it, once it finally booted, it was, you know, I don't know, half an hour later or something, you know, you have to go through a couple of reboots and it tells you it's reinstalling all your drivers and everything. Mm-hmm. Then I no longer had any access to any of my network shares. All NetBIOS names wouldn't resolve. And it took me a little while to figure out the cause, but it totally hosed my virtual LAN adapter, virtual switch configuration. And, you know, doing a little searching, these were common errors and problems, you know, that had, that just would happen usually from reconfiguring and, right. You know, the hypervisor. But this just happened through a Windows update. I didn't reconfigure anything. And then the resolutions were all specific to Windows 8, Windows 8.1 server, you know, 2008. Mm-hmm. None of the fixes really worked for Windows 10. The best I could do was actually, you know, get the actual physical driver working again, and I'm still don't have my hypervisor working.
No.
So, you know, it's supposed to be, you know, just an update. It's not supposed to totally hose your system, you know, when you're ready to go to bed. You know, and so it was like a couple hours of frustration there. And then it's like every time I open any kind of document, mm-hmm. you know, pops up a thing saying, you know, what program do you want to open this with?
Right.
You know, this is your default. Do you still want to use it? It's like a reset all these settings. And then like the drivers for the video card, like normally I have to, you know, set up the drivers to do that slow DVI scan or whatever for these older Samsung monitors.
Oh, right. Yep.
Yeah. I have to reset that up, you know, and it's all kinds of things that just get cleared as this process of this Windows update. And if it's so invasive, they shouldn't be pushing it on you, you know?
Interestingly, I, inspired by your,
rant
experience, yeah. I decided that I should update my Windows as well. And I did a check for updates and it did find that update. And then it appears that it failed, but it didn't go into my log as having failed. And now I go into the Windows update. It says that it's up to date. I have your device is up to date. Last check today at 2:16 a.m. And
what is WinVer reporting?
WinVer reports build 10240.
Yeah, that's the original Windows 10.
Yeah.
Still.
So, I mean,
it actually kind of failed to update the first time for me as well. It like said, it's updating your computer, and then the screens went blank, and then it sat there for like half an hour, with occasionally the hard disk light going, but you know, nothing on the screen. So then I tested to see if I could remotely like still access like the Telnet server and stuff, and I could. So I'm like, it's not shutting down. And I can't see anything. I can't see what I'm doing. There's not, you know, control alt delete, nothing on the keyboard would like bring up the display. So I just ended up hitting the power button on the computer and it immediately turned off. So I'm like, well, I don't know what it was doing. I turned it back on. Then it told me that the update had failed eventually once I got it, you know, booted. And then I had to re-download it and reapply it again. And, you know, and then of course I paid the price with my hypervisor getting all messed up.
Right. So you might have hosed the update just by not waiting long enough.
I don't think so, because it never actually, I think it was like just downloading it or something, you know, when it had cleared the screens. I don't know what had happened, but it hadn't actually gotten to the point where it was like rebooting and applying it, you know?
Yeah, I understand.
So, no, I don't think it was
I don't know what's up with my Windows update either. And
so, I don't know. Beware. I mean, if these updates are not going to be, you know, low touch, then they should be a lot more optional, or they should give you warnings.
Well, are you on the early access plan, or are you on the regular?
The regular. I mean, I didn't do anything special. I'm not trying to be a beta site or anything. I figure they got, you know, plenty of beta testers. They don't need me.
Well, and even if they don't, they hopefully have plenty of testers. I mean,
yeah, paid testers.
I mean, they make their staff use their latest OS. So they're basically using all of Microsoft as beta testers.
They should, yeah.
Well, I remember before Windows 8 came out and we went to the Microsoft campus for a thing, and everyone was using Windows 8 for everything with the new interface and everything. And just about every time they shared their desktop, you know, either in the conference room or in that weird room in the hallway, it was always Windows 8, and people would talk about it. And
we're like, what shit
this,
it was.
Is this really what it's going to be like? Like, don't look at that. Don't pay attention to that. This is, we have to use this. So it was very,
that's like an emperor has no clothes thing, you know. It was such crap and such a shitty idea, and they're really having trouble backing away from that now.
Well, but the interesting thing was when you watch them use it, you actually learn the different ways of doing things. So they clearly got some pretty good training on using it, right, at some point, because they were effective. And so because they got this training that, you know, Joe Public didn't get, they can be effective in it, so they just don't understand why everyone else can't be effective in it. You know, it's like, why are you having problems? All you do is hit the Windows key and type something and then hit enter and it launches.
Yeah, but who wants your entire desktop to go away every time you hit the Windows key?
What does it matter? You know, if you want to do something, hit the do something key, type what you want to do, and hit enter. And then
I don't know. Sometimes it matters. Sometimes there's something happening on your screen that you want to still be looking at while
Well, then
you're
why
doing
do you want to interrupt
thing?
It by doing something else?
Multitasking.
Whoa.
Clearly it wasn't a good idea. That's why they backed away.
Yeah, no, that's very 90s of you to say that. But, yeah, I mean, they managed to be very effective. And I think that I actually learned a fair bit just being there. So that when I actually did get Windows 8, it was like, oh, this is how it's supposed to be used. This isn't bad. You know, I think I had a much more positive opinion of Windows 8 than you did. And I think,
well, I managed to, you know, get it to work a lot more like Windows 7 using the classic shell.
Right.
And then with Windows 10, it defaults to that user experience.
Right. Whereas I never even bothered trying to turn my Windows 8 into Windows 7.
Yeah, well, I did, because I like the other benefits of Windows 8. So, you know, Classic Shell just kind of fixed the whole start menu thing, took away the charms and, you know, just the dumb parts. But, you know, it's funny, like 2 days ago on my way home, I see a lot of license plates, a lot of cars on the freeway on my way to and from work. Anyway, and there was a custom license plate, you know, personalized plate. Uh-huh. And it was Whiskey India Nevada
November.
November Romeo Tango.
Yes.
And I was like, what? If that was my plate, I'd freaking change that thing.
Maybe he really likes Windows RT.
Well, maybe he was involved in the development or something. So made me curious. Like, is it still a thing? You know, like, what is the status of that? So
it's kinda effectively dead. Yeah, there was an update recently, but it wasn't as up of a date as the rest of it.
No, it was kind of a weird hybrid thing where they just kind of took part of the Windows 8.1 improvement and patched it onto.
Yeah. You know, they clearly didn't care, but they got an update anyway. And, you know, they haven't done any new ARM tablets.
Yeah.
I'm sure all the Windows RT devices are going to start falling apart pretty soon. So.
Yep.
And no one else made any, right? I mean.
No, but they still support ARM, but it's with Windows 10 phone or whatever, the Windows 10 for ARM thing, which is not Windows RT.
Right. The Windows 10 mobile is quite a different thing.
Yeah. Oh, I don't know. Is that what they call it? I thought it was just Windows 10 phone or something.
Well, now they just call it Windows 10.
Yeah.
But that's confusing.
Yeah.
It was definitely Windows 10 mobile for a bit. You know, in the Windows RT time frame, there was the Windows 10 mobile. And that was the one for phone.
Yeah, there is a Wikipedia page for Windows 10 mobile. Looks like at least some people still refer to it as that. But that's their ARM operating system.
Well, I think so. Windows 8 was Windows 8 phone. And then I believe now it's Windows 8 or Windows 10 mobile. I don't.
Okay.
I think that they might have switched to mobile with 10.
Yeah, they call it a version of Windows Phone operating system.
Oh, right. It was Windows Phone 8. Yeah. It wasn't Windows 8 phone.
And that's what you still run on your phone, right? Windows 8?
Windows 8.1 on my phone, yep. And the Windows 10, they're actually making it capable of becoming desktop-like. So you can actually hook up a keyboard and a monitor to your phone.
And, yeah, it still won't run desktop apps, but...
Well, it'll run desktop Windows 10 mobile apps.
Yeah.
You know.
Not your...
So, you know, and they plan on doing, like, their Office, like, Excel and Word and that kind of thing. Things you'd want a keyboard for. So, I mean, it'll be interesting. I mean, there was a time I was actually... I actually pre-ordered a smart book, it was called, and it was a phone sized device with a CPU and a monitor and everything and battery in it.
Oh, it's a convertible thing, right?
Right. But it was like a, what's that Apple thing that they sold to play music, but it has a touchscreen and you can use iPhone apps on it?
iPod Touch?
An iPod Touch. So it was like an iPod Touch form factor, and then that slotted into a tablet form factor. And the tablet form factor had more memory, more storage, a bigger battery. And then you had this tablet with that you could take your mobile out of. And then that slotted on the keyboard, which had even more battery capacity. I don't think it had any more computing resources, but it had more battery. And, you know, end up with a laptop. And I thought, this is going to be the best thing ever. And then they, you know, canceled that project and never built it. But
what was the name of that?
It was the SmartBook.
Oh, SmartBook.
And it was the successor to their ThinkBook, I think. They'd actually done a product before that didn't have the iPod Touch thing. And so I was like, yeah, no, you know, there's a real possibility that this will happen. And, you know, they had videos and stuff like that that, yeah, Always Innovating was the name of the company. And, yeah, they made a touch book, which was a convertible
netbook. Did you actually give them money, or you just pledged money?
Well, I gave them my credit card information and said, before you ship it, you know, bill me. And they never actually took the money.
Okay.
But.
Now, I thought Motorola had something like that. It was like a phone that, you know, you could put inside a laptop, and it powered the laptop or something. There was some...
Well, for me, the 3-in-1 was really something I would actually be interested in having, you know, because that would allow me to, you know, do tiered storage, have, you know, if I want to take something with me, I just make sure I move it onto the, you know, mobile form factor thing, and then, you know, bulk storage goes off in the tablet. And I'm a big fan of keyboards. My tablet is mostly just used for games and some web surfing while I'm watching TV is about all I use my tablet for. My phone, I basically don't use, you know, unless...
You use it to make phone calls.
Right.
Which you don't really do.
Right.
As evidenced by your voicemail message.
Yeah. Yeah.
Should figure out some way to play that into the podcast.
But, well, you could call it up with Skype, right?
Yeah, we'll just give people your number.
No, I'm saying call it with Skype. I'm not saying tell other 555.
I saw another personalized plate recently. It's a here. So decode this one. Tell me what you think it says.
Mm-hmm.
India, Alpha, Mexico, Foxtrot, Alpha, Romeo, Tango.
Well, clearly it says I am fart.
That's what I thought it said. But I, you know, it was all together. You know, there were no spaces.
Mm-hmm.
And I just thought that was odd. I mean, if it was a mistake, like it's supposed to say something else.
Well, maybe there's an IAMF art department somewhere.
Yeah, yeah.
I am for art.
Or well, it's like, or he's
used to have
far.
You used to have
he's far something.
Angels WC.
Me, yes.
And
it was a gift. It wasn't my idea.
I'm just saying you used to have it. Maybe yeah. I am fart was a gift as well. And you know,
he's a fan of art.
You think. Okay, Angels, so he's a baseball fan. He's a fan of the Angels baseball team because they're a local baseball team. Maybe you have other reasons, I don't know. And but WC, that's like World Cup. And baseball doesn't have a World Cup.
Or yeah.
Maybe they do. You know, isn't that thing that they play every 4 years, isn't that called a World Cup?
Well, no, it's World Series. Oh, no, no.
No, World Cup. World Series is every year, right?
Now there's they have a
baseball
World
Cup, right?
No, so it's called the World Baseball Classic.
No, it's called the Baseball World Cup.
World Baseball Classic.
No. It's called the Baseball World Cup.
What are you talking about?
There's on the Wikipedia page. It's called the Baseball World Cup. And the first thing that Wikipedia page says is not to be confused with World Baseball Classic.
I've never heard of the Baseball World Cup. Okay, so do not it clearly wasn't that two, thing that I've
but
never
I know
heard
about
of.
That because Canada played in it. I think we lost every single year, but no, there was like, anyway.
Okay, that looks like it's an Asian thing, the Baseball World Cup.
Canada and the U.S. are in it. In 1938, Great Britain won the Baseball World Cup.
All right, so let me tell you the story about why I ended up with an unfortunate license plate. Because the Angels won the World Series in 2002.
Yes.
And I had season tickets that year. And years before that as well. Mm. But, you know, I think it was the last year I had season tickets. Maybe the next year. Anyway. And then after they won, I mean, I was absolutely thrilled. It was their first time even playing in the World Series and then to win, you know. But I had a van and I painted the back windows with, you know, like shoe polish or whatever, some white stuff that you paint windows with. And I put Angels World Champs, you know, and drove around with that on my back window for a month or something. Anyway, so Elizabeth, who wasn't my wife.
And that was when there was two non-U.S. teams in the able to play in that same game. Right?
Yeah, not the Expos were in Canada then.
Yeah,
yes.
Yeah.
Anyway, so when you win the World Series, you're considered the world champs. That's just the nomenclature. All right?
Anyway. It's the world part that I have an issue with, well, not the champs part.
I know. I never understood it as a kid either. But anyway, Elizabeth thought it would be a good idea to get me a gift and get me a personalized plate and not consult with me first. So she got me Angels, ANGLS, WC. And I had that plate for, I don't know, like 10 years or something. And I kept hoping they'd win the World Series again, so my that plate would make sense.
It still would make sense, because WC does not stand for World Series.
World Champs.
Right. But that doesn't spring to mind.
No, I know. It's more like Water Closet.
Yeah, there's that. I mean,
some people they thought I was a coach or something. Like, we thought you were some kind of coach for the Angels.
did anyone actually know what it meant? Did anyone guess correctly at any point?
I have no idea. Most people did not mention it. Well, I mean, I had the frame said Angels fan or something, or Angels Anaheim. I mean, people figured out it was the Angels. They just didn't know what the WC
was. Right, the Angels part I had no problem deciphering. It was the WC that I had to ask. And I actually, as I recall, I had to ask multiple times. Because it made so little sense to me that my brain just didn't retain that information.
Yeah, well, I finally got rid of that. So you did something. You did a couple really cool things for BBSing just in the past couple weeks. I know we talked about the whole JS Store thing. It's like two podcasts ago. We talked about the idea, and then in the last episode, I think you'd already had something kind of working.
Yeah, I think I had the binary compiled.
Yeah, and you were starting to develop the door kit,
right?
Which ended up being the name.
Yeah,
it's in a good JavaScript, name. And then you actually installed WWIV.
Yes, I did.
And got your system. Full screen editor working in there.
Yeah, I did the full screen editor first.
Yeah,
you know, because I think it's kind of the more interesting thing for other BBSs, because if there's one thing I noticed logging into other BBSs that are like Windows or Linux based, is that they don't have a good editor, you know, ever.
Yeah.
So I have to learn how to use this archaic, painful internal editor. And I'm like, you know, the full screen editor, people will use that, not because it's great, but because it's better, you know. So that was kind of where I went first with Dorkit. And I installed WWIV, ported it to FreeBSD, which was easy, much easier than porting Synchronet to FreeBSD was. And
I've heard now three times.
Well, it's true. I mean, clearly they cared more about the Linux support at the time I started the port.
Right.
Than 10 years difference. When I started the Synchronet.
15 years, whatever. Stuff. Yeah, it's like 14, 15 years difference.
I don't know that they've been working on the Linux stuff for 14, 15 years, though.
Well, but they've had 14 or 15 years to do it.
But they didn't. So it doesn't really matter. I mean, you could have started the Linux support way before the year 2000 or whatever year you started the Linux support.
Okay.
I mean.
Anyway.
So.
All right.
Anyway, regardless.
So you got FreeBSD or WWIV working on FreeBSD possibly for the first time.
Probably for the first time.
I think somebody else ported WWIV to Unix, like just generic Unix port a while back, but that didn't make it back into the actual official source, I don't think. Anyway.
I didn't know that.
As a side note. Yeah, I think there's a WWIV/X. Somewhere. I don't know that it's actually open source or if it's just a guy, you know, his own project.
Well, before 5, it wasn't open source, so...
No, I know.
Yeah.
But people got the source, though. You know what I mean? You could buy the source, basically.
Yeah.
So it was readily available.
Well, and one thing that I really noticed when I first fired up my WWIV BBS was just how much of a ripoff of WWIV Synchronet really is. So much WWIV seeps through that it's obvious why Synchronet was at one point in time accused of being another WWIV hack.
I don't think from the SysOps perspective it looks like WWIV at all. It's only from the user, from the command show.
Well, I spent a lot more time as a SysOp than as a user. And, you know, I mean, even... There's a lot of stuff. I mean, if I didn't know better, I would believe that they had a common ancestor.
Well, that's what happens when you start a project and you kind of clone somebody else's.
It's not criticism. I was just very much struck by it. And then the differences became much more stark, right? Because I log on to my WWIV BBS. I'm like, hey, I know this. This is basically like Synchronet. And so I'm reading, you know, a message or something. I go to reply to it and I hit A because that's what you hit in Synchronet. And, you know, a message editor comes up and I type my reply and I save it. And, you know, it says sending email to the original message. Yeah. I'm like, what? I replied.
I made the same mistake on Eli's board.
Yeah. And, you know, so the differences become much more obvious because you think it's basically the same. And then when you encounter differences, it's vastly different. But anyway, so I did that. And then the next thing I ported was my Cannons and Catapults translation to JavaScript. And that's kind of where it's at now. Right now, there's still kind of some sharp edges and some bits that need work on. It doesn't yet actually do the time online tracking, that kind of stuff. There's a few other things that it doesn't do that it really should.
Does KNK actually track your time online on Synchronet?
Well, of course it does, because Synchronet does.
Okay, but you didn't actually have any specific code in there to enforce that. You're just depending on Synchronet to disconnect the user.
Right, basically.
Okay.
I mean, I think there's an add exit thing that handles it, but
saves your
right. User you instantly lose. King Computer wins, and you know the score list is updated. I think is what happens, but I'm not sure of that. I could be wrong, but. You know, it is enforced, whereas with Dorkit, it's not actually enforced.
Not yet.
Yet.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's
something you want to do.
It is something I want to do, and the local screen is something I haven't done yet, but I want to do, and, you know, stuff like that. And then the actual binary needs some tweaking. I mean, right now it uses the same command line format and the same code really as JS exec, which was really designed for like something extra different. Little stuff. It wasn't really designed for interactive things. It was, you know, like for send mail type emulators,
right.
Or you want a wget type thing written in JavaScript. That's how you do it. So its design isn't really for an interactive thing. So, you know, there right now to run a JS door thing, you have to have like 7 different command line arguments, which, you know, wouldn't make sense to run it to have set as anything else if you're running it as a door. So
yeah, you want to make like a configuration file that.
Well, I want to not need those, right? So I need to change the defaults for JS door so that it defaults to something better for being a door kind of thing.
Anyway, it was really cool. I did log on to your WWIV BBS. It's getting more activity than your Synchronet BBS.
Well, hopefully.
And KNK was cool. The ANSI music worked and everything. And I didn't see any obvious problems. Seemed to work great.
Yeah, there's still some issues, but it's definitely coming along. And once I'm feeling better, I'll definitely be sinking more time into it, at least getting it to a certain point before I get bored and move on. But I do want to, you know, translate all of my doors, all my JavaScript, whatever they are, to JS doors. So they become doors. Even if they're not doors now, they will be doors in the near future. And then ideally, I'd like to actually go through the other stuff that's been written for Synchronet.
E-chickens and that stuff. And well, they should do that, right?
Well, see, they have a big development stack going, right? They have a bunch of libraries that all build on each other, and then they build their doors on top of this tall stack of other libraries. So, you know, really, I would like to go and get those underlying libraries done up.
Like Funklib?
Not Funklib. Funklib needs to die, but, you know, like frame.js and
it's the library of funk
and their database thing, their socket based database thing, getting all that stuff done. And then, you know, doing one or two of theirs and showing them, you know, now that all the underlying libraries are done, it's really trivial for you to actually turn this into a door.
Yeah, the database stuff should just work. I don't think that would need any change at all.
I think it uses like the system internet address and stuff like that. I think it actually uses some stuff from the system, so it needs like a configuration. It needs its configuration file extended to have that extra stuff.
Okay, you are setting up a system object, aren't you?
There is adk.systemObject.
Oh, it's got a different name.
It's got a different name. It's got different contents. I mean, it's different. And yeah, I don't want to overwrite the existing ones because Synchronet will still run them natively in process. Like, it won't fire up a new process to run these things. So, you know, if it's running on Synchronet, you can use the entire Synchronet object model. If you're not, you have to use the one in Dorkit. So,
anyway, I'm really happy to see the progress there. And I think, you know, sysops of other BBS software, users of other BBS software, will really appreciate it.
Yeah.
I mean, it doesn't really do anything for us other than it makes those doors maybe more popular, better tested, more motivates people to write these JavaScript doors more, which would benefit every sysop that, you know, it can run on, whose system it can run on.
Well, so we can stop feeling guilty about doing cool stuff that nobody else can use. That's really the thing for me. I mean, I went through a period a few years ago where I found all the door sources I possibly could, and I, you know, painstakingly translated it to C and modern door kits and modern BBSs and stuff, and
checked it all into cvs.synchro.net.
Not all of it. No, I got a bunch that I didn't. And, you know, I did some stuff for people who are still working on money, like Ambrosia Test of Time, the Chassware, like Gutterball, stuff like that. You know, I helped them out, that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, once the whole do it in JS thing started taking off, I just started translating stuff into JS because, you know, that was way easier.
Yeah.
So,
but everybody gets the source, though. I mean,
right, and that's like that that's idea, good for me too. You know. So,
you know, I'm not trying to monetize it, but even you could probably still monetize the door in JS. You know this.
Oh, you totally could. You monetize, could sell it. And, you know, yeah. Don't give it away, and that's there. It's monetized. I mean. It's not that hard.
Well, it's just people want to try to lock things down and make it more difficult for people to cheat the system. But, you know, they still sell plugins and themes for WordPress.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I don't think any of that stuff's encrypted or encoded in any way.
Oh. Well, I mean, quite often what they'll do is they'll run it through an obfuscator if they're selling it. But
yeah, and you could do the same thing with JavaScript.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Make it possibly a lot harder to get bug reports and meaningful error messages.
Could. Depends on how you do it. But yeah, so there's that. And then I did a little change recently, speaking of WordPress, to get WordPress working with FastCGI on Synchronet.
Yeah.
So all you WordPress sysops, whatever you call it,
people bloggers. That have used it. So I had only heard of it, and I thought, well, I wanted to make a new weed puller website or you know, maybe a new just main Synchronet website. And so I thought, well, I'll check this out, you know, see how it works. It only took a small tweak to get it working with the new FastCGI support, so it's totally fast. I mean, it's, you know, completely usable. I honestly don't see any performance difference between that and like native Apache.
Yeah.
Did
you try it on Windows?
No.
Okay.
I haven't tried any of the FastCGI stuff on Windows yet.
Yeah, me neither.
Oh, so it probably didn't work.
I did do a little bit of testing when I was first starting on it, but then something happened to my Windows system. I don't remember what.
Oh, I'll give it a go. It's, you know, we should do that.
Well, someone definitely should. I probably should, but now I'm more interested in the JS Store stuff. So,
and WordPress is just a massive ecosystem.
Oh yeah.
I mean, it's, you know, that's what you want. I mean, if you want to run, you know, a custom website easy, quickly, you know, and it's all editable just using a browser. Modern
yeah, and you know, it'd be interesting to do something like what I did for DokuWiki and actually do a authentication plugin so you can log in with your BBS account.
Kind of the idea I had was like dynamic content for like getting like messages from the web or from the message boards and kind of
right. putting that, them that would as, be another as thing.
Articles, you know. Whether it's a blog type or just news postings or whatever, but, you know, have it be dynamic so... I mean, you could go full hog and try to do like two-way data exchange or whatever, but you know, it's still BBS software. The main focus is logging in with a terminal, and you know, that's how I post. That's how I try to post everything, right? So right. to me, it's like the main BBS experience feeds these other technologies, whether it's NNTP or the web front end or whatever. So, you know, and that's a lot easier actually going from say like the native database or whatever to maybe like a web API, and then to PHP or maybe just writing a PHP thing that can digest SMB or something. I don't know.
Well, I mean, with the strong JavaScript model, I mean, if I was going into WordPress integration, I would actually do a JSON interface using the Synchronet web server where WordPress can actually do JSON requests to itself, like to the same web server.
Yeah.
And, you know, interface that way.
But for reads or for writes as well, like modification?
For both, yeah, reads and writes. Yeah. I mean, it's pretty straightforward to set that up. And so instead of using, you know, MySQL for everything, some stuff would use this JSON API.
Yeah.
And having a good RESTful API to the Synchronet object model would enable all kinds of cool stuff.
Right. And it wouldn't be just PHP. It'd be anything that
right. could use anything that has a JSON REST library thing.
Yeah.
And it would be fairly simple to do it badly. You know, it's one of those things that would require a lot of work to get it right, and that's why I'm kind of mildly interested in it. But yeah, I got other
WordPress itself. I wasn't immediately all that enamored with it. Mm-hmm. It is slick, but it seems like it's so blog focused.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and it's like I'm not really doing a blog. I'm not, you know, none of the website ideas I have that I won't need to do are blogs. But there are themes and plenty of examples out there of, you know, how flexible it really is. And there's just gobs and gobs of plugins for pretty much anything, you know, any social media or, you know, streaming service or anything that, you know, you might want to, you might already use, you know, you can integrate it with your website very easily.
Well, WordPress originally was just a blogging platform.
Right. No, it's understandable why it looks and feels that way. Cause that's its heritage.
Cause that's what it is. Yeah.
I know, but I didn't. That's not the kind of website. You know what I mean? Like when I chose DokuWiki for the Synchronet Wiki, you know, that was natural. It's a wiki. It's like I wanted it to look like Wikipedia. You know, I specifically chose a theme that looked like Wikipedia. You know, but for, you know, in this case, WordPress, my first reaction was, well, I don't want a blog, and everything looks like a blog. You know, it wasn't until I really started getting down into the third party themes in plugins where I was going, okay, you can really do much, much more with this.
Yeah. And, you know, that's kind of how it developed. It's non-blog stuff is fairly recent, really.
And then there's others, too. It seems like everything's PHP, though, like Drupal and...
There's a lot of big PHP things.
Yeah.
Yeah, Python's kind of on the uptick. New stuff tends to be written in not PHP, but it's going to be a couple of years yet before they really start taking over things like WordPress.
Now, was it you that was recently throwing around the term headless Drupal?
I doubt it.
Where did I hear that? And I was like, anyway, I just happened to be investigating this whole WordPress thing and was looking up other CMS things and kind of checking them out, and you know, the whole Drupal and headless Drupal thing came up, and I don't know
what is that. Headless Drupal.
It's using the Drupal framework but without having it generate the HTML. It's kind of my interpretation. So it's like you use it as an intermediary between the back end, like your database, and then your front end, which is some other, like, you know, framework that you put on front of it. So they're kind of like, I don't know, it'd be kind of like if you broke WordPress into like more like layers, yeah, and only use the backmost layer of it. Anyway, I don't
know. Sounds horrible.
Well, I thought, where did I hear this term? It was recent that I had heard, you know, headless Drupal. That's a new thing. So another thing that happened within the past week, which I think is eventful or whatever and should be mentioned, was this whole Zmodem licensing thing. I know in the last podcast we talked about the passing of Chuck Forsberg. That's just coincidental. I mean, he's the inventor of Zmodem. He had his own Zmodem implementation that was just ubiquitous on Unix systems and DOS systems. I bought his DOS version.
Yeah, yeah.
But apparently that was how he made his income. I mean, that's how he survived, was doing custom fixes or modifications for companies that needed Zmodem, relied on it for something. And that kind of led to the ZMTX RX version, which was the open source code that I based Sexy Z on, and then eventually the sync term Zmodem is also based on that.
Mm-hmm.
So, well, I guess you can tell the story from there. Somebody was trying to get it as a port.
Yeah, it was Ragnarok, right? He was. Was it? I think so. Isn't it Ragnarok?
His real name was on the email, so I didn't associate that with his alias. His
real name.
Yeah.
Yeah, the sysop of the Dark Side BBS.
Okay, it does sound like him, yeah.
Anyway, he's been trying to get SyncTerm into Debian for years, really. And I've been mostly not very useful in that effort. I mean, he's submitted patches to SyncTerm, which I accepted and everything. But at the end of it, I didn't care that much. And some time ago, I actually did up a license file for SyncTerm, which mentioned that the Zmodem implementation was under a different license that wasn't really an OSS compatible license. And,
well, you should have talked about Zmodem. People would have understood what you meant.
What are you talking about?
Go on.
All right. So anyway, and it was mentioned in the license file, and he was working on this. And so he actually dug up the contact information for the copyright holders, well, the authors of this code.
It's one guy.
What's that?
It's one guy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, just like Digital Dynamics was one guy.
Pretty much, yep.
Yeah. And so he actually contacted him. He actually got a hold of him and was like, you know, I'd really like you to relicense this, and, you know, so that I can get SyncTerm into Debian. And the guy came back and said, really, I don't want anything to do with that anymore. I withdrew it. You know, I withdrew support. I kind of pulled back on that years ago. And so if you guys want the copyright, I'm happy to assign it to you. And then you can license it however you want. So.
Yeah, so he signed it to you.
All three of us.
He signed it to you.
No. It's all three of us jointly.
Uh-uh.
Yes.
That's not what the email says.
That's exactly what the email says.
Read it again.
You want me to read it again?
I'll read it to you.
That would be much better, because then when I'm right, I can point it out right there.
Okay. All right. Let me see. Because I actually committed it into the source code so that, you know, we'd have a
where
record of
that
it.
Where is that one? Where is this from?
Yeah, there's a period after your name.
Okay, hold on. I'll look up the email then.
Yeah.
I just don't know which email address it came in on. I think it was
It was like two, or it was at least your Saxtel one.
No, I believe that one actually came. Here we are. Okay. This email is and all associated files to, to Stephen Hurd, period. Ragnarok and Digital Man are named as witnesses to this transfer. Oh, okay, so it's mine. Yay! Well, thank you for your work on my code, Rob. I appreciate that.
Well, I think, I'm not sure. I don't actually have a copyright notice on those, but I don't know. I'd assume the derivative work would be then dual copyright.
Yeah. Okay, sure. That's fine. Yeah,
whatever. Doesn't matter.
Huh. No, I thought it was all three. But
yeah, that's a period after your name. You know, which is fine, because you're very...
Yeah, I don't really care who has the copyright. You know, I don't even really care what license it is, but some other people do care.
Yeah.
So, you know, I'll choose probably GPL. You know, I'd really hate... that's one of the few things that I could actually imagine a commercial product taking and using, and that it would actually bother me a little bit.
Oh, just, like a new terminal program, a new commercial terminal program to compete with Zoc and Hyperterm?
Right. Exactly.
They need Z-modem, so they would grab it from there, naturally.
Well, because it is... probably the easiest to read implementation of Zmodem anywhere.
Well, there are probably better written ones, or at least better written than whatever was open source before I created this one with the help of the ZMTX project. But they're all commercial. I mean, you had to buy them, and I don't think you even got source code. But
right, I'm sure you could buy source code too. But I have never seen a better implementation. So
the only other implementation I had seen in C was Chuck Forsberg's, and to call that C was, I think, really pushing it.
It's special.
Yeah, it doesn't read like any C code. You know,
which was the inspiration for doing this rewrite.
Right.
We based this on.
But, right. So let's first of all, I want to thank Jacques Mathieu, or I don't know how you pronounce his last name, but that's my attempt. Mathij? I don't know. Mattheig. I think he's Norwegian.
Do you? Huh.
Well, I don't know. Was it Norway? No, Netherlands. So he's Dutch?
That would make more sense, yeah.
Yeah. Anyway, so he's the one that wrote this. Apparently he was working for it. He gave us the backstory.
So why do you want to pronounce it differently than Jacques? I mean, it's pretty obviously Jacques to me.
Well, there's an S on it.
Right. There's an S at the end of Jacques.
Oh, I didn't know that. It's not Jacques?
No. So, I've never heard Jacques pronounced Jacques.
Oh, I played in a band with a bass player, Ken Jacques, and that's how he pronounces it. And that's exactly how he spells his
life. Maybe that's how the Dutch pronounce it.
Well, I don't know if he's Dutch.
I don't know. He's
Californian.
What? Is the Netherlands.
No, Ken.
Oh,
the bass player.
Okay, but he is not really part of this, but...
but his last name was spelled exactly the same, so that's why I said Jacques, because I don't know. It could be Jacques. Probably is. I don't know. Anyway, thank you. he was working for some company, and at the time, in his job, maybe it was this MCS company that he had mentioned in the original copyright, but no, that's his company, I think, Matthew Computer Service. Anyway, he was working for some other company, I think he said, and his job was to maintain a version of Chuck Forsberg's source code. And he had just grown so frustrated with fixing bugs in that code and trying to understand it that he just decided it was time to write a new copy. Mm. Kind of like with me and WWIV. Okay. I think it's kind of similar, you know.
Only without the source code part.
I'm not sure what you mean. I had the source code to WWIV.
And you actually spent time maintaining it and customizing it and making it work and stuff?
Yeah. Yeah. No?
Okay.
Yeah, I was the first one to ever have, that I know of, I was the first one to have multi-node WWIV. I had batch uploads and bi-directional transfers and all kinds of features that WWIV didn't natively have. So
anyway, I don't know how much of the story he wants public, so I was kind of...
Oh, cutting me off?
Leaving it. I was kind of leaving it there, right?
Oh, okay, that's fine.
Because, I mean, they were kind of private emails and stuff, so I don't...
Oh, yeah. Well...
I don't know that we want to dig into details, but...
Well, it's the history of that code, that's all. I'm not... Yeah. You know, I mean, he's released the claim to it, so that's nice.
Right.
You know, I think we were using it legally before anyway, because I don't, there wasn't a license.
Well, the license did stipulate that we send our changes back to the authors.
Right. And I had emailed him and tried that, but his email address is no good.
Right.
And I assume the street address was no good either.
Right. So, I mean, we were kind of in a gray area there. So it's great to have that resolved. The only thing that's left now for anyone trying to get SyncTerm or Synchronet into Debian now is our choice of cryptlib for encryption.
You can own that choice.
Okay, my choice of cryptlib. I mean, we discussed it, and I know you looked into OpenSSL and briefly.
Yeah, but I wasn't really doing the SSH stuff and the TLS stuff you did, so it was your choice.
Anyway, cryptlib has a great API, you know, and most crypto libraries do not.
Yeah.
In fact, all crypto libraries do not. The new one that the OpenBSD project's working on does, but it's not... It wasn't ready. It wasn't even begun at the time that we... pulled in cryptlib. So, you know, I looked at it, I checked it out, it's under the Sleepy Cat license, which is an OSS license, so I was very happy with it. And so we've since integrated it into Synchronet and SyncTerm. Synchronet uses it for TLS and SSH, and SyncTerm just uses it for SSH. But apparently, there was some work done getting it into Debian, and, you know, the guy who did the work actually went through all the source files and looked for extra licenses and found some. And so he believes that the cryptlib itself is not being legally distributed.
Wow.
Personally, I don't think that's my problem. I got a copy of it under the Sleepy Cat license, and I'm redistributing it under the license terms. So if there's... You know, and there's no hard evidence that he's illegally distributing it.
But he is making money off of it, though. The crypto probably, guy sells it, yeah.
Yeah.
And, you know, they could sue us for every penny we've ever made off of it.
Well, I don't really know how damages work in stuff like this at all. And I don't know who the damaged party would be or what he's doing, if he's making money off of crypto stuff anymore, you know, so I really don't know.
Yeah.
And I'm fine with that. You know, the guy has it as open source with a permissive license, and I'm using it under that license. You know, if it's a problem and someone comes along and says, hey, you have to stop using it, here's why. You know, and that someone like is a lawyer or actually, you know, strikes me as having a compelling legal argument for it, then I would consider it. But other than that, it's, you know, I'm not a open source zealot. I don't really care, you know, about the exact progeny of every line of code. So I'm just going to use it until it turns out I can't. And then I'll switch to something else because it's just something that does the job.
Yeah, OpenSSL is really, I mean, the by far most widely used crypto suite. You know, it's not without its vulnerabilities.
Well, and most importantly for me is that it doesn't do SSH.
Oh, right. There's open SSH. Is that, I don't even know if that's related to OpenSSL.
They're not related. No, they're not related. And that's apparently a endless source of confusion. But yeah, they both were started about the same time. OpenSSH was actually started by the OpenBSD team. And OpenSSL was started by, like, some guys. I don't think they were actually associated with a different project. But, yeah. It's interesting.
Yep. It could happen. Someday we could switch to OpenSSL.
For me, music is freedom.
Sorry. I just clicked on a browser and it just started playing a video. Thanks, YouTube.
Why did you click on a browser?
I don't know why. It's when I'm sitting in front of a computer. I just...
Yeah.
It was already open.
I'm one of those people who selects text at random when he's looking at things.
And you end up deleting a bunch of stuff and you're like, whoops, what did I do?
No, I don't do that. Like, I'll be on a web page and I'll just highlight a paragraph for no apparent reason.
Yeah. Because you have a mouse and you're on your fingertips and that's what it's supposed to
and
do.
I don't know why.
Around and click things.
One thing I've noticed, speaking of selecting things with a mouse, when I'm talking to someone about something on my screen, I have a tendency to highlight it. And everybody has a tendency to say, could you not highlight that?
It makes it hard for me to read.
Well,
it depends on how it's highlighted, right? If it's like inverse and, you know, the two colors are close together, it kind of looks like you're like redacting it, you know? I think I'm one of those people.
You are one of those people, but it's not just you. It's literally everyone, right? I mean, I'll say, okay, here's the thing I want you to look at, and I'll highlight it.
Yeah.
And I'll be like, I can't. Can you unhighlight that?
Yeah.
Yes, I can. I actually highlighted it so that you would read it. And
you need to change your color scheme, I think, or something.
Yeah, or maybe editor. I just need to use a bigger mouse pointer so I can just wave my mouse. Because people will be, like, clearly reading everything on the screen when I just want them to read this one or two lines.
Yeah.
And it's like, just read the highlighted part. Could you not highlight that? Okay.
Well, I do that in emails now a lot. You know, I highlight stuff or bug reports or whatever. You know, I certainly do some highlighting, but I just use bold. You know what I mean? And I think your editor or whatever is, like, inversing it and...
Well, I mean, it's the same like on a web page. You can't just bold something on a web page, can you? No, you can't.
I think it depends on the browser. But
Well, in my browser, I cannot highlight stuff and bold it. I cannot select things and make them bold. I'm not aware of ever using a web browser with that capability.
Yeah, maybe it's not. But, all right, well.
Yeah.
Thanks for struggling through this with your cold.
Yeah, I don't know if it's a cold. I don't really know the difference between a cold and a flu and a whatever other things give you sore throats and headaches. So,
I think flu is like if you have a fever and you're throwing up or diarrhea. I think those are kind of like the flu symptoms. Do you have a fever?
I didn't this morning.
That's probably a cold.
The first time I woke up.
Yeah, sore throat sounds like a cold. All right, well, I will start...
The outro?
The outro.
Ah.
Which is not my favorite outro music.
We'll be back eventually.
Yeah.
Hopefully next week sometime.
Happy
American Thanksgiving.
Yeah. When was the Canadian Thanksgiving?
It's like the third Sunday in October, I think.
Oh, okay. Wait,
no, wait. It's not the third. The third thing, that's the American thing. So it's the second something. The second Monday. Second Monday in October.
Oh, okay. All right. Happy Thanksgiving.
Happy Thanksgiving. Right. And celebrate those pilgrims or whatever.
Celebrate religious persecution and immigration.
I thought it was the pilgrims. I thought the pilgrims was the big American thing.
They were
pilgrims and the Horn of Plenty.
They were persecuted because of their religion. They were Quakers.
pilgrims were persecuted in North America?
No. That's why they came to North America.
Okay, but... Yeah, so Thanksgiving is not about persecution at all. It's about getting out from under, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, okay. All right, good night.